This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford. Coming up, Obama's health care plan is described as the biggest insurance scam in history. And 14 countries around the Caribbean are demanding Europeans pay reparations for slavery. But first, a federal appeals court last week halted enforcement of a lower court ruling that New York City stop and frisk policies are unconstitutional. What's more, the appeals court threw Judge Shira Scheindlin off the case, claiming she was biased against the police. The appeals court decision is a victory for outgoing Mayor Michael Bloomberg and his police commissioner, Ray Kelly. However, Robert Ganji of the Urban Justice Center's Police Reform Organization project isn't all that upset. He says the real action isn't in the courts anyway.
Our judgment is that while litigation and legislation can be helpful, they're not the critical components to the ultimate success of the police reform movement in New York City. Our effectiveness has always depended on our ability to affect the politics of the issue and to dramatically shift the political landscape. In fact, our mantra could have been taking off from it's the economy stupid of the Clinton campaign to it's the politics stupid. And for a variety of reasons, including the good work of reform advocates, the politics of this issue have changed dramatically. All the leading candidates for mayor in the Democratic primary spoke out very critically about stop and frisk. Most of them, including Bill de Blasio and Bill Thompson, who were the leading vote-getters in the Democratic primary, pledged to replace Ray Kelly. De Blasio, who all the polls show is almost certain to be our next mayor come January 1st, he's not only pledged to replace Ray Kelly, who is the police chief ultimately responsible for stop and frisk, but to end the quota system that drives bad police practice, to withdraw the city's appeal that the Court of Appeals just ruled on, and to he's pledged to implement the provisions of Judge Scheindlin's ruling. So, again, while disappointed, we're confident that at most this represents a detour in the onward progress toward significant changes in police practices. The ad with his 16-year-old son, the TV ad, has been credited with helping to provide a significant boost to his campaign. I think some people think he wouldn't be the leading candidate at the moment if it wasn't for that ad. And that ad focused virtually entirely on my father will correct stop and frisk. So in order to maintain his political credibility, he has to follow through on that campaign pledge.
Of course, whatever a Mayor de Blasio would do would be an executive decision that could be changed right by himself or by the next mayor. It would have been far better to have a judgment stand that said stop and frisk as practice is unconstitutional.
I understand that point, and I don't fully embrace that point. I think it's always tricky business, and the reforms you achieve will always be fragile if you're depending on litigation and not depending on a change in the political climate. So that I think a stronger determinant for the change in stop and frisk and for the change in a whole spectrum of abusive police practices in New York City will lay more with the politics of the issue, with the fact that the public over the last year and a half, 2 years, has been significantly educated on this issue, and that, for example, the polls show majority of the public supports changes in stop and frisk. And I think that's going to be more significant in determining what happens in the city than the outcome of litigation. I mean, we reform types have had many, many years of experience where there's a court ruling requiring changes in practices of different government agencies, and those changes never really take place because the government agency isn't committed to those changes and different ways tries to undercut and subvert what the court has ruled. But if you change the politics, you change the political climate, you change what the people, the voting public in the city really want, then you effectively create a change on the ground.
And all of that presupposes continued agitation so that the mayor doesn't change his mind.
Right. I mean, we are certainly committed at PROP, the Police Reform Organizing Project, to continue our public advocacy and organizing. I'm virtually certain that the other groups in the city that have worked on this issue will continue to speak out publicly and to organize politically on the issue. And plus, I believe that de Blasio is not just making promises to court electoral success. I think he truly believes that the way the NYPD has implemented stop and frisk during the Bloomberg-Kelly tenure has been unconstitutional, has been illegal, has represented the unnecessary harassment of people in the city, particularly low-income young black and brown men. And I think he's strongly committed to stopping it. It's not acceptable kind of thing to go on in any city.
Of course, de Blasio's position is essentially mend it, don't end it.
Right. The way we see it, and we're not sure exactly how de Blasio sees it, is mending it would mean ending the way stop and frisk is practiced today by the NYPD. Nobody objects, including people at PROP, including the most ardent civil libertarians, to police stopping people who are truly engaged in suspicious behavior. The problem with stop and frisk, the tactic that's implemented now by the NYPD, is they stop and sometimes frisk over and over and over again every day people who are innocently going about their business, going to school, coming home from school, running errands, standing in a hallway of the building where they live, and they get stopped. They get frisked, sometimes they get arrested, sometimes they get verbally and physically abused, and that's what we're committed to having stopped, and I believe that's what de Blasio will stop.
That was Robert Ganji of the Urban Justice Center's Police Reform Organizing Project. Until relatively recently, stop and frisk was not a top priority of most traditional black organizations and politicians. But 2 years ago, Carl Dix and others, including Dr. Cornel West, launched a militant civil disobedience campaign under the banner of Stop, Stop and Frisk. The organization has confronted police at precincts all across New York, leading to many arrests and prosecutions, and bringing the issue to the forefront of public attention. Carl Dick said the appeals court ruling is a setback, but it won't stop the movement.
Well, my very immediate reaction was that the federal appeals court stopped and frisked Judge Scheinlin and did a number on her, but in doing that, slapped in the face all of the people who hate stop and frisk, who breathed a sigh of relief when they heard her ruling and thought maybe something was going to be done about the way that black and Latino people have been criminalized and demonized through that racist, illegitimate NYPD policy called stop and frisk.
Some people might think the fix was in.
It certainly came through that way. I was sitting in court when the city made its arguments for the stay, and just listening to them legally, it didn't make a lot of sense, because it was pointed out if they were saying, well, we would suffer irreparable harm if our cops were not allowed to stop and frisk hundreds of thousands of people. And even one of the judges pointed out, well, if this is such a bad thing, how come you didn't come to us right after the judge issued her ruling? And, you know, the city's lawyer hemmed and hawed but couldn't come up with an answer. So legally, it didn't sound like they had much to say for themselves. But essentially what's being said here is that the judge's decision, which in my opinion did not go far enough, stop and frisk needed to be ended, not a process set up to figure out how to reform it. But in issuing that decision, she created a lot of public opinion against stop and frisk, not only among the people who were tired of being stopped and frisked, but there seemed to be some fear that the cops were becoming reluctant to do that because perhaps they could get caught up in discipline for being overzealous in their persecution of blacks and Latinos. So somewhere, somewhat was decided, we have to issue a very strong statement, and that strong statement was to go beyond what the issue was in court, because the city wasn't asking for the judge to be removed. They weren't asking for her to be chastised, but the appeals court panel took the opportunity to do that, and it is a big slap in the face.
The federal appeals court ruled that the judge acted improperly, and that seems to taint the entire proceeding, as if one has to start from scratch all over again.
Yeah, and this is the most curious part of this ruling, because the interviews that she gave, she did not comment on the case before her. And the media doing the interviews drew quotations from court rulings. I mean, the court rulings are part of the public record. They can do that. So the judge issued no improper statements. And they're almost like saying judges should not do interviews, which judges do all the time, up to and including the Supreme Court justices. They talk publicly about stuff. And as long as she wasn't talking about a case right before her, which she wasn't, there was nothing improper there. And see, them finding impropriety in that, but seeing no impropriety in stop and frisk itself and the way that it criminalizes and demonizes Black and Latino youth, is the real story here from my perspective. And I'm sitting there in court listening to one of the judges saying, the judge basically was agreeing with the city that it is an irreparable harm for the police not to be allowed to stop and frisk as many people as they want, and citing drops in the number of stops to cite this harm. Then when the lawyer for the plaintiff said, well, judge, crime has dropped while the stop and frisk are dropping. And then the judge says, well, you can't bring that kind of statistical evidence in here. So in other words, statistics that favored his position were fine. Statistics that clashed with his position were not to be allowed in the courtroom. And that approach follows through in this whole ruling of staying the judge's order, allowing no remedies to be done around stop and frisk. And it points to a decision pretty high among the powers that be in New York City that stop and frisk cannot be allowed to be even reformed and slowed down, which is something that people need to reject. This is a slap in the face to every Black and Latino parent who fears what's going to happen with their children if they're confronted by the NYPD, to everybody who doesn't want to live in a society where people can be treated like criminals just because of the color of their skin. And it must be denounced and rejected.
And it could also have a chilling effect on the judiciary, at least those judges that are willing to entertain suits of this kind. The judge was basically charged with being biased, that is, being prejudiced against police.
Yeah, and see, what it comes down to is it's a statement on the part of this appeals court that judges who are partisan towards justice need to watch out. Because that's what came out of this court ruling. While I didn't feel it went far enough, what the judge did is she looked at the preponderance of stops, who was being stopped, why were they being stopped, what was the outcome of these stops, and determined that this was being applied in an unconstitutional manner. No one has yet gone into this and showed why all of these stops of people who were doing absolutely nothing wrong and were overwhelmingingly Black or Latino was proper. But it comes down to that, don't even think about issuing a decision like this. And it's a broader message than that. It's a message to people in society who would side with people who hate being stopped and frisked or speaking out about it. It's a message, don't even step out around that. Stay in your place. Let us do this to people we determine we need to do it to. And it just has to be rejected.
And of course, you at Stop, Stop and Frisk have always said that the real battle is in the streets anyway.
Yes, and we're going to be taking it there in response to the ruling in the days and weeks to come. We're going to call on people to join us. And folks should check out the Stop Mass Incarceration website, which is stopmassincarceration.net, for our plans our analysis and everything else about not only this ruling, but the whole slow genocide of mass incarceration and all its consequences.
Carl Dix, speaking from New York.
Obamacare has gotten off to a very bad start with a non-functional website that may not be fixed in months. However, the website may be the least of the program's problems. We spoke with Dr. Margaret Flowers, a former congressional fellow with Physicians for a National Health Program and co-director of It's Our Economy. Dr. Flowers was co-author of a recent article titled Obamacare, the Biggest Insurance Scam in History.
In the United States, we've been for the past 40 years treating health care like a commodity, something that you would go to the store and purchase like, you know, other goods, consumer goods. And the outcome of that is really clear, that it's the most expensive and it leaves the most people out, and it means that people are only able to get the amount of health care they can afford instead of what they need. And the Affordable Care Act, and I always cringe when I say that because it's not affordable, but Obamacare actually takes us further in that direction of privatization. And what we're hearing now, you know, this whole conversation about this new marketplace and whether the website works or not really distracts us from the real conversation we should be having about whether we want to continue on this path of market-based healthcare and treating it like a commodity, or whether we want to actually join the rest of the industrialized world, our neighbors to the north and the south as well, and create a healthcare system that treats healthcare as a public good, something that everybody needs. And the only way we can do that is through some sort of single-payer system or a Medicare for all.
What this administration has embarked upon is a massive marketing campaign for private insurance.
Yeah, it's amazing, really, when you step back and think about it. And we looked at the whole kind of process of even passing the bill and how it fit all the stages of what a con person would do or in a scam. But that scam continues, and even now the government is paying hundreds of millions, actually billions of dollars, to set up these exchanges all around the country to sell insurance. They're marketing the insurance products for the insurance companies. They're paying people to actually go out and knock on doors and giving them maps to tell them where the uninsured people live so they can go and peddle their products. And the sellers actually get paid on a commission based on how many policies they sell. And then we're spending billions of taxpayer dollars to subsidize the purchase of private insurance. I mean, what better deal for a private insurance company could there possibly be?
In fact, insurance stocks have gone way up since the passage of Obamacare.
That's correct, and they continue to go up even though the exchanges are faltering and struggling. The profits continue to go up.
You talk about a scam. Did it start off with bait and switch? After all, lots of voters, especially Democrats, thought that they were going to get something like Medicare for all from this new 2009 administration.
Right. I mean, if you weren't listening carefully all, even during President Obama's campaign, and the fact that he came out of a state where he had supported single payer, had a lot of people believing that that was the direction he was going to take. And I think the real scam was the public option that was used to make people who support health reform and actually support a Medicare for all or single-payer system believe that the so-called public option was actually a backdoor or a step towards a single-payer system. And on one level, it's important for people to understand that would never actually accomplish being a backdoor to a single-payer system. But the other is that people weren't aware that the public option was never even intended to be in the final legislation, so the whole thing was really just a scam to get them to be distracted and support that and not fight for the real solution.
And yet now many single-payer supporters in Congress and out there in the public are acting as if defense of Obamacare is the same thing as pushing for single-payer.
Yeah, people have been so confused. Even since it passed, members of Congress were calling it a universal health care system. It's not. They've been calling it an affordable health care system. It's not going to be affordable. This is why we have to recognize that it's important not to believe this kind of mass media message and to really go to those who understand health policy and understand from them what it is that's actually happening. And this is a typical neoliberal economic policy that is already undermining and privatizing our public insurances and pushing us farther in the direction of a market-based healthcare system, which is inherently unequal. It leaves people out. It means people only get what they can afford, not what they need.
Are the problems with starting up the system causing people to take a more skeptical look at the whole concept?
It is. It points to the complexity of this kind of a system. When you have a system of hundreds of different insurance plans and different ways that people are eligible for different things and eligible for different subsidies, and it just makes it so much more complex than it ever needs to be, and it's why our system already has the most expensive, well, it's the most expensive system in the world, but we also spend the greatest amount of our dollars on marketing and bureaucracy, things that have nothing to do with health care. And the Affordable Care Act has just made our system even more complicated, and that's why we really, it begs for the simplicity of a Medicare for All system, which means that everybody's in. There's one set of rules, and it's about health.
Medicare is probably the most popular government program. It started in 1965, and it only took 6 months to get everybody enrolled.
That was before the age of computers as well. That's because when you have a universal system like that that's publicly financed, so we pay up front just like we pay for our roads or our school, when you go to receive health care, you're already assumed to be in the system, and so the first thing you get is health care. And then if you don't have all of your paperwork in line, that can be dealt with, but that's not a barrier that keeps you from getting care like it is in our current system.
Will the existence of the Affordable Care Act strengthen or weaken Medicare, which we know works?
It's already weakening Medicare. Obama actually had said throughout the health reform process that he was going to try to get rid of the Medicare Advantage plans, which are private insurance plans that prefer to take, and they do take, the healthiest patients, and they spend the most of our public dollars for these healthiest patients. That's because they have a high profit margin. And instead of weakening those Medicare Advantage plans, he's actually giving them even more money than was originally intended in the legislation, and we've seen a 30% increase in those plans. So it's really kind of gutting our traditional Medicare, and we're really heading in a direction. We're seeing signs from those who are involved in the process that Medicare will likely become completely private insurance system, I think, within the next 5 years. And that is going to mean that seniors will be just like the rest of us, only able to get the amount of health care they can afford.
After all these years of austerity, much of which we owe to the Obama administration, what are the chances of reviving single payer?
Well, I think we have an excellent opportunity right now because it's just going to become more and more apparent over the next year and beyond that this type of a system does not work and more people are going to be struggling within it. And so that's why it's fundamental that we have this conversation right now about how we as a nation want to treat health care. And it's time for us to get organized and start making that demand and building the mass movement that it's going to take to create this type of change.
That was Dr. Margaret Flowers, co-director of It's Our Economy, speaking from Baltimore.
The 12 English-speaking countries that make up the Caribbean Economic Community, called CARICOM, plus Haiti and Suriname on the South American mainland, have banded together to sue their former colonial masters for the crime of slavery. The black nations have hired a London law firm to bring Great Britain, France, and the Netherlands before the International Court of Justice in The Hague, the court that handles disputes between nations. The former colonies say the effects of slavery continue to hinder their national development. Are these 14 nations really serious about meaningful reparations? We asked Omali Yeshetela, chairman of the Black Is Back Coalition and also head of the African People's Socialist Party, which holds its International Congress in St. Petersburg, Florida, on December 7th.
I think that reparations for a while now has been an issue whose time has come. And I think that despite the limitations of the leaders and class that's involved in making the suit and certainly the unreliability of the European criminal courts to deal with it, despite all of that, I think it's extremely significant that this has occurred. As you know, the reparations issue has been one that's extremely important to me and to my party for a number of years. But the thing that we run into historically is, I think, the same thing that we're seeing with this demand that's coming from the CARICOM countries. And that is, it seems from what I've been able to see, that they're simply asking for a kind of payout and nothing that actually challenges the relations of power and the kind of economy, economic relationship that exists between Europe and the U.S., for that matter, and the other oppressed nations and countries around the world. So I think that even in this country, where in 1982, we held a World Tribunal on Reparations for Africans in the United States and indicted the courts of the United States. And we had a lot of forces who were talking about the reparations issue, but what they were really wanting for was a payout. With one group even saying things like, you know, we want reparations so you can get your teeth fixed or your new car or your house painted. And I do believe that the crisis of imperialism at any given moment can become serious enough that England and France and others would be willing to offer a payout, a payoff. It solves their consciousness. It gives the impression of having solved the problem. It mutes the demands by the people in those Caribbean countries for a genuine settlement of their grievances. They can claim that they've already dealt with it with this pittance. And I believe that it may even result in some kind of pittance, just as the same law firm was responsible for the so-called suit against England for Mau Mau atrocities, and that was a pittance, and I don't think it would place a dent in the well-being of the colonizing countries.
Even if they're just looking for some modest payout, could some good come of this? These countries have pledged that they're going to do an intensive study to reveal just how slavery impeded the national development of their countries. That could be a good educational exercise, couldn't it?
It's going to be a major educational exercise, because the thing is that once the leaders of those countries suggest that they're going to be demanding reparations, people are going to start doing it on their own, regardless of what the governments do. I can even see the threat of looking into it representing a certain kind of embarrassment that would have England and France, perhaps, and even the Netherlands to offer some kind of payout. But I agree that an investigation looking at this is going to be an incredibly significant event, because many of us, including Africans in this country, have been convinced by our oppressors that it is our own ineptitude that's the basis of our poverty and not our relationship to this parasite that's been sucking our blood. And so at the moment Africans begin to look into the history of this process, I think that it will help to foment revolutionary consciousness throughout the Caribbean and in African world, because the Caribbean is a part of the world, and Africans everywhere have the same kind of relationship to white power as they do in the Caribbean. So I think it's going to be extremely important, this investigation, and whether, again, the governments do it or not, I believe making the demand is going to see more and more people in the Caribbean, scholars, students, and what have you, and activists begin their own investigation.
The United States and European countries have always treated reparations for slavery as some kind of very complex problem with no solution. But the West has always, after every war, up to and including the Iraq War, recognized war reparations. And wasn't slavery and the keeping of millions of people in slavery a kind of war?
Indeed it was, and the truth of the matter is that after the successful revolution in Haiti that freed the first successful workers' revolution in the world, France demanded reparations from Haiti for its lost property, which, of course, was the Africans ourselves, and the whole white world, including the United States, placed an economic embargo on Haiti to force Haiti to pay white France for its loss of black slaves due to the uprising. So reparations is not something that's that complex when it comes to something that they want to do. And that also brings us to the question that many times people who talk about reparations, as they're doing here with CARICOM, they talk about the examples of the Jews being paid reparations by Germany and other entities in Europe. But that's not recognizing, of course, that the U.S., the European powers needed that illegitimate state of Israel to pump it up, grow it up, give it an economic power so that it could maintain its relationship as an arm of imperialism itself. But reparations is not that complex when it's something that they are demanding from somebody else.
Haiti, under President Aristide, demanded that France pay back those reparations that it had demanded of Haiti for the slave owners. France responded by teaming up with the United States and overthrowing Aristide.
That's right. And the fact is that, of course, that Haiti paid those reparations for almost 100 years to France. And you're right, the U.S. ganged up with them. And, you know, the statement of the significance of the whole reparations demand can be found in the Haitian Revolution, because the success of the Haitian Revolution shook the entire world economy that was organized around slavery. And so when the Africans in Haiti won freedom and then said that any slave in the world who got to Haiti would be free, that was a fundamental contradiction that could not be tolerated. So this question of reparations, this question of the significance of the resources that have come to Europe and to North America of stolen labor, stolen land, stolen resources, is fundamental to the understanding the nature and the existence of imperialism.
The United States sabotaged Durban 1 in 2001 and Durban 2 in 2009. Those were international conferences on racism, and many believe it was because the United States wanted no discussion of reparations.
Indeed, that is the case. And I think it's worth mentioning that the first time the United States or someone who would come close to representing the United States would come out and say no to reparations was Barack Hussein Obama. When he was in his first presidential election and the first so-called presidential debate that happened in Harlem, New York, when the question came up about reparations, Obama came out flatly in opposition to reparations, which, of course, gave all of the other candidates and every president henceforth the ability to say that without having to be accused of being anti-African, since Obama himself said that. But you're right. They did everything they could to sabotage this. Israel, I think Canada, were among those who walked out. The United States didn't even send a major representative. But that Durban 2001 was a fundamental turning point. I believe that it is as much a milestone to the crisis of imperialism as what happened just a few short days later with the 9/11 and the subsequent evolvement of the struggles of other peoples around the world who were determined to change their relationship with imperial white power, and in my view, which contributes to what we see now as a shift in the balance of power in the world that would allow usual quislings like CARICOM to come up and barking and demanding reparations.
You're chairman of the Black is Back Coalition, and you're head of the African People's Socialist Party, which is having its sixth Congress in December. What's on tap?
Well, I think what's on tap is this Congress is one of the few times that we've seen like revolutionary African organizations or political parties actually bring our people, our membership, and anybody else, you know, who really wants to participate in the Congress, certainly as observers if they're not members, to a central location where you have a democratic process where we put forth the basic line, we put forth the main resolution in the form of a political report that attempts to sum up the world, our place in it, what it is that we have to do, and that would elect its leaders and things like that in full view of all of the observers and everybody who wants to come. I think that this is an incredibly significant thing. We will have people here from our party who will be from Africa, certainly from Sierra Leone, and I think that we're having Africans from Kenya having some problems with visas, but hopefully from Kenya, from the Bahamas, from Canada, from throughout the United States, from Sweden, from Germany, from England. So it's going to be a magnificent opportunity to pull together African people and others. There'll be representatives from the Mexican National Liberation Movement. We had expected comrades from the Romani or so-called Gypsy community to have got here from Germany, but they ran into some serious kind of economic problems and won't be able to make it. But it's going to be a dynamic 5 days of discussion, struggle, putting forth what we believe to be some important kind of theoretical advances and hopefully consolidating a powerful organization expression of the intent of African people around the world to be free from this relationship that we've had with white power for the last several hundred years.
And the sizing up of the world situation from an African perspective.
Yes, and I think this is about time. And I think that for the last several years, the last couple of centuries, we've gone into some discussion about our conditions based on assumptions that others have made. And we've, I think, of finally freeing ourselves enough to be able to see the world from perspectives that's specific to our circumstances, but also recognize that our circumstances are a part of the overall world and how we fit into that world, as opposed to in the past where someone said, this is the world or this is you, and defined us to fit their needs and their aspirations. We are now saying that we are subjects of history, not simply objects of history. This is how we see the world. This is how we see white people in the world. This is how we see other people in the world, as opposed to the other way around.
Omali Yeshetela of the African People's Socialist Party.
The worldwide movement to boycott the State of Israel has picked up another member organization. The Association of Humanist Sociology is demanding that U.S. cut off all military and economic aid to Israel, which it calls an apartheid state. Dr. Johnny Williams is a professor of sociology at Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut. He's also vice president of the Association of Humanist Sociology. He explains what the group wants from Israel.
What the Israelis should do, from our perspective, is, as we said in our statement of support for the boycott, divestment, sanction movement, is to end the occupation and the colonization of the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, and the Golan Heights, and give it back to the people that they took it from in 1967. And we also ask for a dismantling of the wall, which is basically dividing up the West Bank and taking away even further Palestinian land and annexing it to Israel itself in an illegal fashion in violation of international law. And also, we wanted Israel to recognize the fundamental rights of its own Palestinian-Israeli citizens who are treated like second-class citizens, pretty much on the lines of apartheid in South Africa. And lastly, we want them to respect, protect, and promote the right of Palestinian refugees to return to their homes and properties as stipulated in the UN Resolution 194, so they have a right to return to what is now Israel itself. So those are the things that we want the Israelis to do. And if they don't do that, then we call for a boycott of all things Israeli, and to get them to do, in the tradition of the civil rights movement and anti-apartheid movement in South Africa, to get them to do what they don't want to do, and that is to give back the property and the lands of people who they took it from illegally.
And the right of return is number one on your list. The Israelis say and have always said that that is non-negotiable, that if they allowed the Palestinians who were driven out to come back, then that would change the demographic character of Israel, and Israel would no longer be a Jewish state.
Well, first of all, Israel has never been a Jewish state, so I don't know where they're getting that from. Within its borders, 20% of its population is Palestinian, and there are others who are there too. Increasingly, there are Filipinos, there's African migrants and so forth, who they are trying to turn back, because what drives this is this kind of xenophobia and this idea that somehow that this is a Jewish state and it is the property of people who are Jewish only.
A huge proportion of the inmates in Israeli jails are Africans who have come to Israel seeking work.
Yes, but the Israelis treat them as if they're criminals. There was a video that was put out. It was actually commissioned by the New York Times to run about the state of African migrants to Israel, but they didn't like what they saw, in the sense that the video showed Israelis saying some very racist things about Africans that we thought had long passed into oblivion. But in actuality, they bring up the issues of Africans being murderers, Africans being dirty, and not wanting to have them nowhere a part of Israel, that it will somehow bring down Israel if Africans came into Israel itself. And so now they have decided to basically keep them in tents in the desert, as well as in the prison system and so forth. And they also have within that prison system a whole bunch of Palestinian children who are also in jail alongside of those Africans, as well as other Palestinian activists and so forth.
Much of the most racist behavior among the Israelis emanates from the settlers, half a million of whom are on the West Bank. And disproportionately, these settlers are Americans.
Yeah, and that's striking. And just to think about it, basically they have imported this kind of American racial thinking and behaving and acting and organizing themselves. It's similar to what happened with the Zimmerman case and Trayvon Martin. Is that you have these guys who have weapons, and they're going after people who are Palestinian, whose land they occupy, because they see them as less than human. And so it's okay to shoot them, run over them in cars. There's a video of these American settlers running over Palestinian youth who was throwing rocks and killing them and shooting them point blank just for being in a field, shouting at them saying, go home or something like that, just shooting them outright. I mean, that happens all the time, and there's no consequence. There's no consequence whatsoever. They're not charged with anything. They're not held accountable. So it's similar to what's going on in the United States. So they're importing that stuff over to the occupied territories and treating these folks the same way that black folks are treated in the United States.
Israelis and their supporters get apoplectic when the word apartheid is used to describe that country.
I remember when the apartheid movement was going on in the 1980s all around the college campuses and so forth. And the university I attended was a Jewish sectarian university, Brandeis University. And I remember mentioning, while I was a part of the anti-apartheid movement in the Boston area, that what was going on in Israel was very much similar to apartheid to some of my friends who were Israeli. And the person who responded, she got very upset about it, but her sister, who had served in the IDF, did not get upset about it. And she said essentially that I was being very factual about what was happening, that it is basically an attempt to subjugate a people. And so I thought I was on the right track. But, yeah, they get very upset when you say that what they're doing is apartheid, because it really is. The Palestinian Israelis cannot live anywhere they want to. That's basically restrictive covenants to where they can actually go to school and live. I mean, they're in ghettos. They're being ghettoized by Israelis whose own ancestors were ghettoized in Europe. That's something very troubling, that people who know what it feels like to be segregated and so forth and mistreated in this way are now doing it to people whose land they have basically occupied illegally and taking territory from them illegally.
Your organization is called the Association for Humanist Sociology. Mm-hmm. How is that different than the, let's call it, mainline sociologist organizations?
Well, mainline sociologist organizations themselves are more preoccupied with careerism, from my perspective. But the Association of Humanist Sociology isn't just preoccupied with just publishing papers and talking to people within the profession. We're interested in sharing information with people who are out there engaging in trying to transform the world. Our work is not merely to talk to each other, but to help and to provide our input about how we might go about together transforming the way our society is into a better place to transform the world. So our objective is not merely to interpret what is happening, but actually to transform it. And that's what we seek to do.
And that's why you found the Israeli issue unavoidable.
It simply is. I mean, we can't stand still on stop and frisk either. We can't stand still on what's happening on the African continent in Rwanda and in the Congolese right now. We can't stand still on that. We have to, because of our work, which demands sociology is about transforming the environment in which we find ourselves, the human societies that we find ourselves in. It is not merely about interpreting data. That's not what we do. And this makes the Association for Humanist Sociologists different because it is out there trying to do these things. So it's applied sociology. It's not just merely studying things. You see, it's seeking to transform it.
That was Dr. Johnny Williams of Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut.
Democrats and Republicans alike constantly mouth the mantras of so-called school reform, by which they really mean privatization through charters. Increasingly, that also means militarization of schools. Black Agenda Report Managing Editor Bruce Dixon has this commentary.
Doug Henwood, a radical economist and founder of leftbusinessobserver.com, sums up the goal of bipartisan corporate education reform imposed upon poorer neighborhoods as succinctly as anybody when he calls it low-cost privatized holding tanks, leading to McDonald's jobs for the lucky and prison for the not-so-lucky, along with remote education via computer rather than unionized teachers. As useful as his summation is, however, it leaves out one element worth noting. You cannot run a global empire without a military class, any more than you can run a prison without prison guards. In Chicago, the front line of so-called educational innovation, mostly because its current mayor, President Obama's former chief of staff Rahm Emanuel, holds dictatorial power over the public schools, one of the showpieces of education reform has been the handing over of entire high schools and even middle schools to the Army, the Navy, and the U.S. Marine Corps. before the era of corporate education reform, there was at least one achievement of genuine small-d democratic education reform pushed through by the administration of Chicago Mayor Harold Washington back in the 1980s. Since then, parents in every Chicago public school have been allowed to elect parent councils with reps from among rank-and-file teachers, which have veto power over Title I funds and principals' contracts, which are limited to 2 years. The innovative answer of downtown bureaucrats, corporate elites, and subsequent mayors to parents taking a hand in actually running the schools has simply been to close Chicago public schools and replace them with charters over which parents and rank-and-file teachers have no say. This year, Chicago closed more public schools than any other school district in a single year in the nation's history. None were charter schools. This week, Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel announced that he was moving the middle school, which had earlier been given to the U.S. Marine Corps, into the facility of a fully functioning neighborhood school, Ames Middle School. The fact that Ames School parents and community members had testified, had met with officials, and had overwhelmingly rejected the closing of their school meant less than nothing, and may even have contributed to the replacement of their school by a military academy. What mayor and what alderman really wants organized parents running their own neighborhood institutions? It's bad for business if you're a privatizer or a politician who takes cues and campaign contributions from privatizers. And ultimately, habits of local democracy are bad for empire. What Chicago and what corporate education reformers and privatizers and their contractors nationwide want, as Henwood observes, are low-cost holding tanks to funnel the well-behaved into low-wage precarious labor and jail for the disobedient and the unlucky. They want distance education and computerized instruction because those are cheaper than human, potentially unionized teachers. And to Henwood's list, we should add, they want a sprinkling of military charter schools. Because after all, you can't run an empire without soldiers or a prison without guards.
Bruce Dixon, managing editor of Black Agenda Report.
Mumia Abu-Jamal is America's most famous political prisoner. He's serving a life sentence in the death of a Philadelphia policeman back in 1981. For most of that time, Mumia was under a death sentence. He's off death row now, but thanks to the volunteers of Prison Radio, Mumia tells another story of life, death, and innocence in the American prison gulag.
The Fletcher Rule. I speak today of a man on death row, a man known to many as Two Guns. For many, perhaps most, the words death row and the nickname Two Guns are all that needs be said, for taken together they paint a picture tinged with guilt. But this is not that case. Anthony Fletcher is his birth name, and his nickname was his boxing name. The Guns, his fists, which took him to the brink of greatness in the ring, where he fought and bested great fighters like Boom Boom Mancini and Livingstone Bramble. Until 1993, when a Philadelphia jury convicted him of shooting a man whom Fletcher claimed was shot in self-defense. Under today's law, Fletcher would have been acquitted, if not charged at all, but this was 93. In 2004, a Philadelphia judge granted him a new trial after a pathologist admitted he gave erroneous testimony at his trial as to whether a struggle occurred. In most states, that would have been the end of it, but not in Pennsylvania. In 2007, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court threw out the new trial, used a dubious claim used at the original trial, false, misleading testimony by medical examiner Dr. Ian Hood, and reversed the post-conviction judge, reinstating a first-degree murder conviction and a death sentence. Anthony Two Guns Fletcher was sent back to death row. If the mistaken pathologist and a crack-addled so-called witness hadn't presented false, misleading testimony in the first trial, there wouldn't even have been a conviction. But there you are. In Pennsylvania, self-defense isn't self-defense if they don't want it to be. In fact, jailhouse lawyers here think two guns got sent back to death row for the most greasy of reasons. He refused to plead guilty to third-degree murder, and thereby allowing the DA to keep an unjust, unreliable conviction.
That was Mumia Abu-Jamal.
From 1968 to 1973, a dynamic program called Soul graced the New York area television airwaves. Produced at public television station WNET, Soul was hosted by Ellis Hazlip and featured some of the leading lights of black culture and politics. Recently, WNET hosted a Soul Summit to discuss the program's legacy and the future of black media. One of those in attendance was Dr. Todd Burrows, an independent journalist and recognized authority on the history of African American media. Dr. Burrows says Soul and other programs of the era were children of the black liberation movement.
The rebellions in American cities and the Kerner Commission report, of course, Chapter 13 of the Kerner Commission report, criticized the media's coverage of the black community. Those two things caused a great hand-wringing in white liberal circles. And one of the responses was that commercial and public broadcasting developed what are known as black public affairs programs. Soul and its sibling Black Journal were PBS's responses to the rebellions and the Kerner Commission. So whereas Black Journal talked about blacks from a news magazine point of view, Soul was an artist's showcase. And what I'd like to explain is that the difference between Soul and its little cousin, Soul Train, is not only about 2 or 3 years difference in terms of which show premiered first locally or nationally, but it's also the idea that even Soul Train, as radical as it was, basically portrayed black entertainment, whereas Soul dealt with the black aesthetic, the black political, cultural, and even a spiritual milieu.
You described it as 360 degrees of blackness. It didn't just include black artists, but also prominent black political personalities like Stokely Carmichael, Kwame Ture.
And a very famous dialogue between Nikki Giovanni and James Baldwin, and interviews with black filmmakers like Melvin Van Peebles. So Soul was the brainchild of Ellis Hazlip, who was a major theater figure in black circles. He knew Langston Hughes. He worked with many, many black entertainers and artists and actors. He had this huge, big black book where he could call up Sidney Poitier, Harry Belafonte, and get them on and get them to talk about their art from the perspective of their art as black people in a struggle for black liberation.
And why did Soul leave the air after 5 years?
Soul left the air because the powers that be that initially funded Soul did not fund the kind of program that resulted. The program that resulted was very much political, very much cultural, and, you know, for an artist showcase, Soul had a very, very strong impact in terms of its accurate display of black political and cultural aesthetic. So as NET, National Educational Television, became PBS, as local public broadcasting just becomes a local affiliate of a national broadcast network, corporate structures kick in, and not only, as one of the founders of Soul said, not only can nobody be as black as the people at Soul were, nobody could also even be as local. So even the local programming that Channel 13 did. And they did some really strong local programming, including a show called 51st State, which is about the history, which is about the current conditions in New York. A lot of that programming was eventually scuttled and replaced by, let's say, the McNeil Lehrer Report, which is now the PBS NewsHour. So you see that progression from local progressive programming to national corporate programming.
1973 was also about the time that white philanthropic organizations began to lose interest in anything that smacked of the black liberation movement and went on to other giving pursuits.
They did. And, you know, the 70s was a period that started with great promise. You know, you had Progressive FM on the radio, right? you had all this experimentation. And, I mean, Seoul, put Seoul in context, Seoul was the black experimentation in the larger context of the white experimentation in broadcasting. How far could broadcasting go to illuminate what's really going on? And all of this began to fade because, as you said, the powers that be decided that they didn't want to fund that experimentation, decided they didn't want to have that kind of political and social analysis. And by the way, you know, this also happened in white entertainment. I mean, you had movies in the 70s that dealt with real political issues, real social issues. And just as that was replaced by Jaws and Close Encounters of the Third Kind and Star Wars, which begat the kind of movies we have today, the same thing happened to public broadcasting. Public broadcasting stopped showing this very painful mirror to society and began to produce shows like Nova and Nature and shows that, you know, would allow a more comfortable viewing experience.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. And while you're there, check out the latest episode of Black Agenda TV. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the black left. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Melissa Gerson.